From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. This year is the 100th anniversary of the women's suffrage movement, which led to the 19th Amendment and giving women the right to vote. To celebrate the anniversary this month, the La Crosse area chapter of the League of Women Voters hosted an emeritus history professor from the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point to talk about the history of the women's suffrage movement here in Wisconsin. WPR's Ezra Wall has this interview with Teresa Kaminsky.
Dr. Kaminsky, thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. I really appreciate the invitation.
So, getting the vote for women, August of 1920 is when it happened officially, but it was a big movement leading up to that. What was the social climate like in the era when that movement was going on in the United States?
Well, it took a very long time. So I guess what the United States was like itself changed very much from the beginning of the process, which most scholars would put at 1848. So by the time you get all the way to 1920, the United States has undergone a whole lot of changes. And I think some of those changes are probably rooted in the suffrage movement itself, the long-term push for not only women's voting rights, but other rights for women as well.
So the effort in the United States, how did that compare to other parts of the Western world? Maybe the society we might most easily compare ourselves to as far as those of us of European descent, England, they had their own suffrage movement at a certain point. Is this a similar timeline or did ours come later?
There was a very similar timeline with England. I was just looking at a map earlier today of women's suffrage around the world. And the United States certainly didn't come in first and they didn't come in last. So this is certainly a worldwide or global phenomenon that's taken root in different times and different places. But the movement in England was very much overlapping with the United States, and in fact, some notable American suffragists got a lot of inspiration, whether directly or indirectly, from the movement that was going on in England. If you think of women, especially like Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, who started really pushing for that constitutional amendment in the United States, they'd both been radicalized by their involvement in the British movement.
Changing the Constitution, speaking of that, is no small feat. It takes a lot of effort and across oftentimes many, many years. And for a group to undertake that, which is completely disenfranchised at the time that they're trying to effect this change, how did they make progress, or how did they get the rest of society who could vote, essentially the white men of society, to buy into their movement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a couple of things. One is that putting the emphasis on a constitutional amendment for women's voting rights was not the first method that women embraced. It was originally conceived of as a state-by-state effort. Voting rights until the 14th and 15th Amendments had been at the discretion of the states. Individual states decide who their voters are. So women understood this. They understood politics. They understood history. So they were operating mostly at the state levels. You get out and get supporters in the legislature, and you get new laws at the state level. And before 1920, there had been some success with that. So even prior to the passage of the 19th Amendment, some women in different places in the United States could vote. But they couldn't all vote in all elections, and of course, they couldn't all vote across the United States. So that's why by about the time Alice Paul got involved with the National American Woman Suffrage Association, that's why the emphasis shifted from a state-by-state campaign to a constitutional campaign.
So whether we're talking about the state-by-state effort or the effort toward a national constitutional amendment, certainly each state had its advocates, and Wisconsin is no exception there. Let's talk about who the major players were in Wisconsin who were promoting the right to have women become enfranchised.
Right, and there are some notable names. Some of the initial activism actually came out of a rather small town in southwestern Wisconsin called Richland Center. And that's where David James, who was for a time a Wisconsin state senator, and he lived there with his wife, Laura. And they were both very much involved in sort of 19th century reform. Throughout the state of Wisconsin in the 19th century, a lot of activism undertaken by both men and women focused on temperance, which was trying to stop the consumption of alcohol, which we all know ultimately resulted in the 18th Amendment. So women were particularly attracted to the temperance movement because they saw it as their right to protect their families, and they did believe that alcohol consumption was a bad thing and that it threatened the sanctity of the family. So between that temperance activism and abolition in the decades prior to the Civil War, there were many people in Wisconsin who had that kind of reformist bent. Mm-hmm. And it did appear that the Jameses were part of this. And by the 1880s, Laura James had decided the time had really come to revive a state suffrage association that had been kind of languishing for a few years since the 1870s and really helped to get it started again. Also in the same time period, you have Olympia Brown, who was, I think, one of the first female ordained ministers, and she had a congregation in Racine. And she was very much committed to women's suffrage, and she was one of the leaders of the Wisconsin Women's Suffrage Association, and even tested a state law about women in Wisconsin in 1869 received the right to vote in school board elections. And Olympia Brown wanted to test how broadly that could be construed, and she tried to vote in municipal-wide elections, arguing that all local laws had an impact on education, so women should be able to vote in all local elections. But the state Supreme Court shot that argument down. So these were the kinds of things that women were doing in the state of Wisconsin through most of the 19th century, really focusing on changes to state laws.
Did Olympia Brown and Laura James know each other?
I think so. I think probably Olympia Brown was even better acquainted with the Jameses' daughter, Ada James, who in the 1890s and then through the last fight for suffrage, Ada James really took the reins, even with the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association, moving it into the more modern period and really utilizing that slogan, "Votes for Women." She had suffrage supporters out in those new automobiles, and she arranged for leaflets to be dropped from airplanes, and she was really one of the architects behind the 1912 suffrage referendum in the state of Wisconsin. Ada James worked with her father, who I think was out of office by that time but was still very influential, and they finally got the state legislature to agree to have this referendum held, which lost by a huge margin. And it, as you mentioned earlier, you know, how do you convince people to support this? And of course, when the referendum was put to voters in Wisconsin, the only voters in Wisconsin at the time were men. And the fact that some men, and it was not even 40%, but some male voters did support the suffrage referendum, but that wasn't enough to get it to carry. And I think it just really did indicate how strong traditional beliefs about women's place in the home still held on into the early 20th century.
I wanted to ask about that because indeed, the fight for equality for women and even the fight for equality among all people, among all sorts of gender identities now, as we're seeing, is far from over, but really in a way that seems foreign to us now. Women were not part of the leadership of society, and it was really out of the ordinary for people to suggest that they should be allowed to vote, allowed to, in many cases, work outside the home, allowed to play a leadership role in their communities.
Right. And it was, it all kind of went together. The movement for women's suffrage was part of a broader movement for women's rights. Not, I don't think anybody just assumed at that point that women's suffrage was the only thing that women needed, but more broadly based women's rights, which included things like property rights. Most people today, I mean, can hardly conceive of the idea that once a woman got married, she no longer had the legal right to her own salary. If she worked outside of the home, her salary belonged to her husband. Any property she brought into the marriage, whether it was real estate or the clothes on her back, it all belonged to her husband. So part of the early women's rights movement dealt with getting states to change those married women's property rights. And Wisconsin did that fairly early on, I think in 1850. So there was a recognition that that was an issue. Getting women into colleges and universities, first at the undergraduate level, then for graduate training. Most medical schools, law schools, kept women out in some cases into the 20th century. So this was all part of that fight to see women as equal human beings with men, and it still brings up many of the same issues we're discussing today. What does that mean for home and family? One of the biggest arguments against women's suffrage was that it would corrupt women, that politics was dirty business, and that women, their refined natures would just not be conducive to being involved with politics.
So in a lot of parts of the country, and this certainly a state-by-state issue and really in a lot of ways a north-south issue, but in a lot of parts of the country, the fight for the vote for women really was the fight for the vote for white women.
Yes.
What about Wisconsin? Where does Wisconsin fall in that spectrum?
Well, as I was reacquainting myself with the local history, because most of my work on this has been more at the national level. I think Wisconsin kind of fell somewhere in the middle. I didn't find too many egregious racial problems. And by egregious, I mean that's not saying that there weren't any. Wisconsin had a strong abolitionist heritage, but I think a lot of people today realize that the abolitionist movement was not necessarily one that promoted a true racial equality. It was one thing to end slavery. It was quite another thing to promote racial equality. And I think most white people in Wisconsin were still very sensitive to that. And there was also the issue in Wisconsin about Native Americans and what that meant in terms of citizenship and voting rights. But I think in general, the women's suffrage movement in Wisconsin was probably no more or no less welcoming to women of color than its other counterparts in the North. Southern states, of course, were much more explicit in their exclusion of women of color, and that did permeate into the national movement as well. So the story there is not a particularly good one. It's one that the legacy of the women's suffrage movement really has to deal with, and I think scholars have been trying to confront that more head on. I mean, even some of the women that we tend to revere in the women's suffrage movement, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, made some powerful arguments for excluding people of color from voting rights in favor of white women. And it's so hard and so disappointing to read those kinds of things now.
We look at these things through our modern lens, but is the with the ability to kind of go back in time a little bit and observe some of those ideas that were promoted, is there any notion that they might have been willing to allow some of these exceptions because that's how they advanced the issue and they knew that pushing the racial side of it more strongly would be a turnoff to the people that they needed to support their movement?
I think that's one of the justifications that's often floated, was that it would be too hard to pull everybody in this direction if it's asking for too much. But, you know, we hear that argument so much. And for it to be true, it would have meant that all suffragists believe this. And that wasn't true. I mean, if you look at women like Lucy Stone, who often disagreed with Stanton and Susan B. Anthony about suffrage issues, including their concepts about race. Lucy Stone was maybe a bit more progressive. She did support wholeheartedly the 14th and 15th Amendments, which provided voting rights for African American men. And in her case, she said that was perfectly justifiable. That was right because of slavery. And she said in that case, once you have voting rights for black men, then you can start bringing in other groups of people. So I guess it all depends on where you're willing to put your emphasis. Certainly Stanton and Anthony had a lot of supporters, but so did Lucy Stone. So that possibility was always out there for an all-inclusive movement. And actually for a very brief while, even Stanton and Anthony tried their hardest to promote what they referred to as equal suffrage, that everybody over the age of 21 gets to vote, no matter race, gender, everybody gets to vote. When they read the language of the 14th Amendment and realized where this was all going, that's when they realized that equal suffrage was not going to work for them. Other people held on to that for a longer time and did see equal suffrage as a real possibility, but it didn't work.
When I was growing up, my first exposure to the issue of suffrage for women and the whole movement culminating in 1920 was the Susan B. Anthony dollar, because
right.
there was a dollar coin that was produced, way back in the Stone Ages that had Susan B. Anthony on it, and I was running up to my mother and my grandmother, and who is this on the dollar coin? And they would tell me about her. How did the movement in Wisconsin interact in any way with national figures like Susan B. Anthony and others?
Yes, it did, and it very much depended on scheduling and the practicalities of travel. And I was having this conversation earlier today about just the dedication of these women who would travel around different parts of the country to promote suffrage. And in 1869, when the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association was first founded, both Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were here in the state, and they were traveling around and giving talks about suffrage, and so they were very much helping to get this statewide movement going. And the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association did for a time ally itself more closely with Stanton and Anthony. A little bit later on, they were worried about the increasing radicalism of those two women, but especially Stanton. And incidentally, that's why we get a Susan B. Anthony dollar and not a Elizabeth Cady Stanton dollar, because to put Stanton's picture on a coin raises all sorts of issues. And Stanton was much more controversial, not only because of her issues about race, but she was considered to be a religious radical. She actually rewrote the Bible to take.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she took great exception to the way men had written the Bible.
Okay.
So she wrote her own version. And she also had some very, for the time, very radical views about divorce, in that women should be allowed to pursue divorce. So she really was considered to be a radical. Susan B. Anthony, not so much.
In terms of some of her racial ideas, maybe not up to speed with what we would think of now, but in some of her other ideas, really ahead of her time.
Right, right. And I think that the main part of the women's movement probably didn't quite know what to make of her, that as she, and you know, this does happen with people as they grow older, sometimes they do grow more radical, and that seemed to happen with her. As she advanced in age, she just really came out with all sorts of interesting ideas, and it's even more fascinating when you realize that this is a woman who married at a not a young age, but when it was considered acceptable for women to get married. She had 7 children, so she was very much a family person, but she had very clear ideas about what was right and what was wrong in terms of gender relations. And the older she got, the less willing she was to hedge on any of that.
Were there efforts in regards to women's suffrage to repress the vote of women once they did have the actual legal right to vote, like there have been in, like we think of the repression efforts against African Americans or others?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an example of that, and I can't really think of anything. And this may tie into, as you said, kind of concerns after 1920, when the 19th Amendment was ratified. Everybody was wondering, well, what's going to happen? How are election results going to change now that women have the right to vote? And one of the things that had kind of held back women's suffrage from being successful, especially at the state levels, was women's involvement in temperance, because the liquor interests wanted to prevent women from voting because they assumed that once women had the right to vote, that prohibition would come in and they would all be out of business. And the timing, of course, was a little bit off, because prohibition gets passed before the suffrage amendment. So you can't put that all on women voting. And actually, what happens once women start voting in 1920 is that the results of how those votes played out, I think, more clearly showed that gender really didn't play a part in how they voted. Women were more influenced by other social and cultural factors. What was their class? What was their race? What's their religion? Those things seem to matter more than, oh, I'm a woman and I'm voting. So I think that kind of big gender change didn't happen, but at least through much of the 1920s, I think both major political parties thought that it still could happen. So there was much more cultivation of women as voters and as potential politicians. And we do see almost immediately after 1920 women angling to get into elected office. They were figuring out ways to run for office, get appointed to office. They really saw participation, direct participation in politics, as another form of expressing their citizenship rights.
I know that as a historian, you know a lot more about what has already happened than about what is happening now. But how does your study of this issue, how does that affect the way that you see the current developments in particularly American politics now 100 years after suffrage for women?
I think it kind of plays into my pessimism that much will change. If we look at the gender makeup in Congress, we know that women are not represented there as much as they should be, especially in the Senate. We see women lagging behind. And in terms of presidential candidates, this is still a problem. And it's just really interesting that we've had hundreds of years of male presidents, some of them better than others, and yet voters are always willing to give another man another chance. And this does not seem to hold true for women who are in public office, and I still think it's going to take a very long time. So 100 years really is nothing in terms of change. And I think what we're seeing now is just how much we still have yet to do, that any sort of movement is ongoing, and it's not finished, and it's not, okay, so this has all been accomplished, let's do something else. I don't think it's ever time to stop.
Well, it may not be, but it is our time to stop.
And that was a great segue.
with that, let me thank you for being here. Teresa Kaminsky is the Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Professor Kaminsky, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That's Ezra Wall, the new regional manager of WPR's La Crosse Bureau, who will soon be the new host of Newsmakers. Ezra will take over the show later in March. And that's it for Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our interview on the International Women's Day celebration in La Crosse, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.